Now, we were happy to do that. We want to do that for everybody that joins us at careovercost.org, but we can't do that 248 million times a year. Something's got to change.
Derek Crowe, we only have about 30 seconds, but I wanted to ask you quickly, Medicare Advantage, which Brian Thompson ran for United Healthcare, the privatization of Social Security. We're seeing all these ads about open enrollment the past few weeks. What are you urging in terms of the government's use of this privatization of Medicare?
Well, we must stop the government from turning over Medicare to companies like United Healthcare through privatization schemes like Medicare Advantage. And we've also got to get policymakers to take the claims review process, the appeals process, out of the hands of corporations like this and get our healthcare focused on people's needs and not corporate profit.
Well, we'll leave it there for now, but of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. We're going to do a part two with the two of you. We hope you can both stay to talk about where you're directing your efforts now as we move into the Trump administration part two. Derek Crowe with People's Action Institute speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Wendell Potter, former executive for the health insurance companies Cigna and Humana. He's executive editor of Healthcare Uncovered and author of the books Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and also the book Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381, or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Amidst the UnitedHealthcare CEO assassination, a family in Oregon was charged $60,000 for an ambulance ride. Washington County will see more transitional housing construction. And, in international news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu goes to court. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 10th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem. Health insurance company Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield denied an Oregon family's claim for ambulance coverage until local TV station KGW started covering it. In 2022, a five-year-old from Medford fell, breaking her elbow. There weren't any pediatric orthopedic surgeons in the area, and doctors said she should be airlifted to Portland for emergency surgery. The surgery went well, but the bill came in at $60,000, a price their insurance company said the family would have to pay. Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield claimed the air ambulance was not medically necessary. There's been a spike in insurers denying people's claims for coverage for ambulance calls. A recent federal law, the No Surprises Act, is meant to protect patients from unexpected medical bills. But insurers can get around the law's requirements if they say the treatment or ambulance ride wasn't medically necessary. Late last month, KGW emailed Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield about the Medford family's case, and 9 days later, the claim of coverage was approved. A spokesperson for the insurance company said they didn't even have enough information previously to see that it was a medically necessary ambulance ride. This comes amid major public outcry from Americans about the health insurance industry itself, sparked by the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Breanne Thompson last month. Washington County just approved over $40 million for transitional housing projects in Hillsborough and Cornelius. The funds come from the Oregon Health Authority, as well as the Supportive Housing Services measure from Metro. Transcending Hope in Hillsborough will receive around $8 million to build a transitional housing facility with an anticipated opening date in spring of 2026. Central City Concern will receive almost $30 million to rehabilitate an existing hotel in unincorporated Washington County. By March of 2026, the site will provide around 80 temporary homes for people experiencing houselessness while they receive substance use disorder treatment. Open Door Housing Works in Cornelius operates a drop-in service center that is too small to meet community needs. County funds will support expanding that center, as well as construction on a lot for an access center that provides public amenities, connections to employment and housing, and other services. That will mark the third access center in Washington County funded by Metro SHS resources. The county anticipates funding another access center in Beaverton in the future. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu just became the first sitting Israeli leader to take the stand as a criminal defendant. In his opening testimony today in a Tel Aviv courtroom, Netanyahu said he is a dedicated leader and a defender of Israel's interests. He called the charges against him, quote, a drop in the sea compared to the challenges he has faced protecting Israel. He added, quote, I waited 8 years for this moment to say the truth, end quote. He believes his testimony will, quote, poke holes in the absurd accusations. Netanyahu needs to address charges of fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases that began in 2020. He is accused of accepting thousands of dollars worth of gifts from a billionaire Hollywood producer in exchange for assistance with personal and business interests. He is also on trial for allegedly promoting advantageous regulations for media moguls in exchange for favorable coverage of himself and his family. Netanyahu is saying the charges are a witch hunt orchestrated by a hostile media, as well as a biased legal system aiming to remove him from office. His administration has been plagued with years of scandals. Even his family has gained a reputation as enjoying a lavish lifestyle at taxpayer expense. The Prime Minister's testimony is taking place in an underground fortified courtroom for security reasons. Supporters and opponents waited outside, with protesters draping a banner that reads, quote, Prime Minister. He denied caring about media coverage, despite the prosecution's attempts to paint him as being obsessed with his image. The testimony is scheduled to take place 6 hours a day, 3 days a week, for several weeks. It will clearly consume a significant chunk of Netanyahu's working hours. Critics question whether he can manage a country involved in a major war while monitoring other potential regional threats, including from Iran. Netanyahu said he could balance needing to appear at his trial with his duties as prime minister. Under Israeli law, indicted prime ministers are not required to step down. Protesters are nonetheless demanding he resign, and some former political allies are currently refusing to serve in government with the Israeli leader. The prime minister, along with his former defense minister, also face an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court for alleged crimes related to the war in Gaza. A verdict is not expected until 2026 at the earliest, and Netanyahu will still have the option to appeal to the Supreme Court. Sunstone Solar now stands as the nation's largest permitted solar project in eastern Oregon. Pine Gate Renewables, a North Carolina company, says it will break ground in 2026 to build a 1,200-megawatt plant. Once fully built out, it could produce enough electricity in a year to match the use of nearly 300,000 Oregon homes. Oregon's current largest solar plant is a Pachewitt Fields project in Gilliam County, sitting at 162 megawatts. The Energy Facility Sitting Council has approved larger projects, though, like the 400-megawatt plant in southern Oregon. Another is the 500-megawatt project next to the Sunstone site, 15 miles south of Boardman. A second 1,200-megawatt project in Sherman County is under review by the EFSC. The current largest operating solar plant in the United States is the 802-megawatt Copper Mountain project in southern Nevada. Oregon is losing local news outlets at an alarming rate, following national trends. Even as distrust in the news media has grown in some circles, a new study shows people trust local newspapers the most compared with other types of news outlets. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon is losing local media outlets quickly, echoing a national trend. This year alone, 130 newspapers nationwide shut down, according to a report from Northwestern University. Bob Singer with the Oregon Association of Broadcasters says readership is low for local papers, which leads to a loss of advertising revenue. He says local radio stations in Oregon have stepped in to fill the gaps left by print media, and those stations are doing okay.
It's not the robust industry it was a decade or so ago because, as we know, things have changed. But I think that they're doing a very good job, especially the family-owned radio stations around the state.
Amid an increasing climate of misinformation and media distrust among some Americans, recent data shows the news outlets they say they trust the most are all local: newspapers, radio stations, and TV stations. Professor Robert Aysen at the University of Wisconsin at Madison says in this polarized climate, where people choose to get their news matters.
It seems less and less that we're willing or able to see things that we may share in common. And that's exacerbated by a media ecosystem where we're not even getting the same information, where we're not even sharing the same basic set of facts.
In the survey, 74% of Americans believe not having a local newspaper would seriously impact their community. Yet more than half of all counties in the U.S. have just one local news outlet, or none at all. In Oregon, 9 rural counties have just one local news outlet, while 5 rural counties have none at all. Although the outlook for local papers is grim, Singer is hopeful about local radio holding on. He says AM radio especially serves a vital role in disaster preparedness and communication for when electricity and cell towers aren't working.
Where are people going for their information? They go to their car and they turn the radio on.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Family safety net programs could face cuts under Trump's budget. J.D. Vance stands behind Pete Hegseth's nomination. And agriculture could face hits if tariffs spark a trade war. With these stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's these public programs that are core to helping families meet the day-to-day needs of raising healthy kids. These have been bipartisan programs that have helped our families thrive.
Myra Alvarez with the Children's Partnership is one of many people concerned about the possible impact of President-elect Donald Trump's budget cuts. Department of Government Efficiency co-chairs Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are spearheading efforts to slice $2 trillion in federal spending, but this almost inevitably puts safety net programs like Medicaid, CHIP, and SNAP in the crosshairs. Alvarez says these are some of the most widely used and popular federal programs. Comments from Musk on an episode of Joe Rogan's popular podcast are being criticized as global warming misinformation. The multi-billionaire claimed that how much beef people eat is irrelevant to climate change. But cattle produce methane, a potent global warming gas, making cows the largest source of livestock climate emissions. Boston University professor Michelle Amazine says Musk is repeating disinformation that started in the industry.
That's essentially the playbook on deceiving people about the harmful impacts of certain products. And so we see this again regarding climate change.
Some farmers also say they're worried about whether the incoming president's tariffs could spark a trade war with China and hurt agricultural exports. USDA reports say commodity prices are already dropping, and soybean farmers in states like North Dakota say they're in no position to lose the Chinese market. Ben Palin with the consulting firm Ag Management Partners says this comes at a time of global ag market instability and increasing export competition.
I just don't think that you can have a coherent and consistent policy for agriculture if you go from one crisis to another.
Threats and pressure by Trump and his allies may be shoring up support for Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth with Senate Republicans, but the public opinion of the Fox News host continues to erode. Hegseth has been accused of sexual misconduct, excessive alcohol abuse, and financial mismanagement of 2 veteran charities. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance says they're not abandoning the nomination.
We're not abandoning this nomination. We're not going to make it easy for people to allow the media to determine who our Secretary of Defense is. Donald J. Trump, who just won an election by a very significant margin with the advice and consent of the United States Senate, that's who determines who the Secretary of Defense is.
Meanwhile, healthcare providers and legal experts are worried about how Trump's second term will impact reproductive rights. In Pennsylvania, abortion is legal through 23 weeks. Signe Espinoza with Planned Parenthood in the state says Trump's win won't change their work, but they will have to engage with state lawmakers to protect women's rights and health.
We're going to continue to do the work that we've been doing, and that is advocating for sexual and reproductive healthcare policies in the state of Pennsylvania, ensuring that barriers are removed. There are currently a lot of barriers pre-Trump administration.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cold and cloudy with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with some showers in the evening and a high of 45. Today in history, Marie and Pierre Curie are awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for their groundbreaking research on radioactivity in 1903. The Curie, or CI, was the unit of measurement for radioactivity, named as such in honor of the two physicists. But in 1975, the becquerel became the standard unit of measurement, named in honor of Henri Becquerel, who shared the Nobel Prize with the Curies. The quote of the day is from Canadian author André Alexis. In 15 Dogs, one of five books in a series, he says, "In the sunny world, with its small things moving too fast, I shy away from light, and in the attic, cuss the dark." President Joe Biden made important remarks at the Tribal Nations Summit this week, and the North Dakota State Historical Society obtained a collection of original lithographs depicting life among indigenous peoples of the Dakotas. With more on those stories, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Joe Biden and members of his administration may be packing up their offices, but at this week's Tribal Nations Summit, they made some announcements of historic importance to Indian country. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is admittedly biased, but she says there's no debating that President Biden has been the best president for Indian country in her lifetime.
And I felt the best way for us to acknowledge that was with a blanket. This is an eighth-generation blanket from a tribally owned business, and I've had it embroidered. It says Joe Biden, Champion for Indian Country, 2021 to 2024.
At the summit, Biden announced he's taking further steps to enshrine his recent apology for America's past federal Indian boarding school initiative. First, he's establishing Pennsylvania's Carlisle Indian Industrial School as a new national monument. It was the nation's first off-reservation federal Indian boarding school that housed some 7,800 children from more than 140 tribes.
We don't erase history. We acknowledge it, we learn from it, and we remember so we never repeat it again.
Boarding schools like Carlisle were meant to erase the heritage of Native Americans and Alaska Natives, which is why Biden also announced he's instituting a new 10-year plan to revive Native languages.
It's a vision that works with tribes and support teachers, schools, communities, organizations in order to save Native language from disappearing. This matters.
President Biden's hoping Indian country is a part of his legacy.
This is my final White House Tribal Nations Summit as your president. It's been an overwhelming honor. I mean it sincerely. An honor of a lifetime. Usher in a new era of tribal sovereignty and self-determination. A new era grounded in dignity and respect that I've seen and experienced in many ways.
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The North Dakota State Historical Society obtained a collection of original lithographs depicting life among indigenous peoples of the Dakotas. What was once hidden in a San Francisco art house are now part of the group's permanent collection. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene reports.
In 1832, Swiss artist Karl Bodmer and German prince Maximilian embarked on a journey throughout the American interior West. One of the results of that expedition were the paintings of dozens of lithographs depicting indigenous life in the region before widespread colonization of the plains. Less than 5 years later, a smallpox epidemic would devastate the local indigenous population depicted in those paintings. Kara Hoff is the public information officer for the North Dakota State Historical Society.
The expedition stayed at Fort Clark. They were down in South Dakota, up near Fort Union. Along the way, a number of significant portraits of different Native American chiefs were part of it. But the daily life, too, of the Native Americans were documented through Bodmer's artwork.
Hoff says it's a rare collection of originals to see, let alone acquire for a state historical society.
Bodmer was working on turning the sketches, paintings, and drawings to transfer those artworks onto plates that could then be stamped or lithographed. They don't come up for auction very often, or even in a complete set very often.
The 1830s originals will be placed into the rotation of the North Dakota Historical Society soon. The collection, featuring over two dozen total works, was acquired via donation from Sam McQuaid Jr., with an earmark for fine art purchases. I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Portland Homeless Services nonprofit Blanchet House plans to open an overnight women's shelter in downtown Portland. Blanchet House is known for offering meals to houseless Portlanders in Old Town, and they run an overnight shelter for men already. The new overnight shelter will be located in the sanctuary of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on Southwest 13th Avenue. There's already another nonprofit, Operation Nightwatch, that offers an evening community space there. The project is in the planning stages, but they expect to open in the spring since there isn't much construction that needs to be done. They expect to serve about 75 people every night. Scott Kerman is the executive director of Blanchet House. He told KGW, quote, "When I told our meal service team we were going to do this, they burst into tears. We are so excited to be able to do something meaningful for the women that we serve who have nowhere to go at night, and women across the country who have been really without a place that they can access each night without a wait list, and some of the other barriers that can sometimes impact somebody," end quote. The women's shelter will be named after a Blanchet House guest named Bethany, who was killed in a hit and run last year. Blanchet House says they'll need to raise $1 million to support the new space and staff. Bashar al-Assad's dictatorship shockingly collapsed after 24 years. This is bound to cause strategic rethinking in the Middle East as well as in Russia and the U.S. But there are many unknowns, starting with what the new Syrian regime will look like and what its international relations will be. Now, we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. They're celebrating in the streets in Damascus. In a collapse as stunning and swift as that of the Soviet Union, the 24 years of Bashar al-Assad's dictatorship has come to an end. Within the past year, Assad's regime seemed to have recovered some legitimacy. The Arab League reinstated Syria's membership last year, and Saudi Arabia in May announced the appointment of its first ambassador since severing ties with Damascus 12 years ago. All the signs pointed to the Syrian army's full control of nearly all of the country. The rebellion seems to have escaped the notice of numerous governments, but now they will have to pay attention to what it might mean for Middle East politics and strategic alignments. The rebellion against the regime originated in Syria's civil war that began in 2011. That challenge to his rule, a chapter in the Arab Spring that also convulsed Tunisia and Egypt, led Assad to turn his regime into a police state. But the regime never fully secured the northwest of the country. In a matter of weeks, the rebel offensive captured the country's largest city, Aleppo, and the rest of the northwest. Rebel forces then advanced on the central Syrian city of Homs, while other aligned armed groups grabbed territory in the south. At least three forces appear to comprise the rebellion, with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, whose name means Organization for the Liberation of the Levant, the most important. The civil war has displaced about half of the population. Around 6 million people sought safety in neighboring countries and Europe, 1 million in Germany alone. How many of these people will return? Will the European Union and other governments force them to return? Probably not many Syrians will want to go home initially. They will probably wait to see what kind of regime the rebel leaders create. Moreover, the end of the Assad regime may not mean the end of instability, since the other rebel groups may seek to maintain control over territory they have seized. In an interview with CNN, the leader of the rebel group, Abu Muhammad el-Jolani, said little about his goals other than to overthrow the Assad regime and establish a pluralistic society. But the HTS's Islamic roots and Jolani's one-time fighting for al-Qaeda led the U.S. and other countries in 2018 to label HTS a terrorist organization. Will that tag remain now that HTS is in charge? Russia and Iran are the key losers in Syria's collapse. Both have lost a Middle East ally. So has Hezbollah. At first, Russian planes reportedly bombed rebel positions in support of al-Assad, but then reports from Moscow said that Putin was disgusted with the retreat of Syria's army and would not try to save his regime. Russia ordered its citizens to leave Syria. Iran did the same, closing down not only its embassy, but also its military facilities. Russia's foreign minister met with Iran's and Turkey's ministers in search of a diplomatic resolution to the conflict, but events overcame that effort. By then, Assad and his family were preparing to flee the country, to Moscow, it turns out. As for the U.S., the Biden administration and Donald Trump made clear as the rebellion unfolded that the United States would not and should not be involved. That is sensible, since virtually nothing is known about what Syria will look like under the new regime. However, there are around 900 U.S. soldiers and contract personnel working with the Kurdish forces in northern Syria. What will become of their mission is a big unknown. Will a U.S. economic role in Syria be welcome? Assad had made himself respectable by throwing the doors open to foreign investors and tourists. An HTS-led government seems unlikely to do that, but it is likely to be hostile to Iran and perhaps open to a cooperative relationship with Israel and Saudi Arabia, though Israel reportedly is preparing to seize the buffer zone it shares with Syria and perhaps other Syrian territory. Here are some other important unknowns. What kind of government will the HTS form, and how will that government behave with respect to human rights, women's rights in particular? Will the new regime seek revenge against officials who worked for the Assad regime, rather than make use of their skills? What will happen to Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons, sarin and mustard gas that the regime used against its own citizens? What will the Kurdish militia that has U.S. support now do, since it was part of the anti-Assad rebellion? Will Iran now turn full attention to supporting Hezbollah after the defeat of its ally? Likewise, how will Russia react to this sudden turn of events? Its foreign ministry regards HTS as a terrorist group. Will Syria become another Afghanistan for Moscow? I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Isabel Charlet. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
Making contact.
Both fighters being called to the center of the ring.
Listen, my comments. Heads up.
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamraini, and to start us off today, we're going to go back to August 1st at the 2024 Paris Olympics to a boxing match between Amani Khalif and Angela Karim.
A final welterweight fight of the session between Algeria and Italy, and we're off.
At first, Khalif and Karini weave back and forth, and Karini lands a punch.
Good right hook from Karini. Khalif looking to come with the straight punches to the body of Karini.
And then all of a sudden, Karini walks to the corner of the ring and she pauses.
Karini just asking to get her head guard tightened in.
She comes back out to fight, and quickly, Khalif lands a punch. It's honestly so fast, I don't even see it.
Solid straight right hand from Khalif there.
And then all of a sudden, Karini quits. 46 seconds into the match, she retreats to the corner.
Well, demonstrating from Karini. She talks to her corner. She's not happy about something.
She's been shouting, "It's not fair, it's not fair." Meanwhile, Khalif looks sullen and worried.
We'll wait on the results here.
Victorious by abandon